Right, so you're very welcome back, or very welcome into the third hour of the 9 till noon show. And we welcome into studio with us our gardening expert, Paul McLaughlin, from Ballacter Garden Centre. You haven't got your own one yet, sorry.
No, not quite yet. There are days I'm thinking about it.
Who'd have thought it? Two waves in one spring, two heat waves. I mean, we had a record, provisionally, the highest temperature ever. It looks like Glenties is going to be beaten. Nope. It was summer yesterday. It felt like summer.
Yes.
For all intents and purposes.
Very much back to spring today again.
Mm. So right. And obviously, people are mad to get out into the garden. That's the way we are.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
So have you seen lots of people coming in with lots of inquiries as to what they can and should be doing?
Yes, huge amount of people in at the minute. All right. Like I say, everybody's just raring to go, so they're everybody's dying to get out into the garden. That's what we've been sort of deprived, even last year was bad, so they're even more anxious to get out this year, if you know what I mean. So the big thing is everybody's jumping, thinking it's time for the bedding plants every time the sun shines, if you know what I mean.
Still too early?
It's borderline at this stage. I don't know whether you believe.
Is frost the factor at this
frost,
point?
Frost generally the factor.
We're not going to see any frost now.
You would hope not. My father, he's one of these boys who watches the animals, and he saw frogs jumping about the last morning, and he reckons the frogs don't come out if there's any danger of frost. So he's actually reckons that's a sign that the frost passed. So whether you believe the frogs or not, I don't know.
Okay. Biltane.
Yes.
What's that?
Baltna.
Baltna.
Yeah. Baltna is the festival. It's basically the Celtic festival that always occurred.
I should know that.
Around May Day. So there's today been May Day and all. Is what I got to, sort of before Christianity, you had Baltna, which was a major festival in the gardening and farming. Garden and farming calendar, basically. It was one of the big festivals that occurred through the year.
And is it still ongoing? Is the tradition still being?
Yes, certain traditions still would be, all right. One big thing that still go on would be people wash their face with the dew in the grass this morning. So I don't know if you've done that or not.
No, sounds like it could be good, though.
Yes, actually, no, it's supposed
although,
to keep.
Although, I put the Roundup down yesterday. No, right. I didn't.
Or watch for the cats.
I wouldn't use that.
But no, about people traditionally, you wash your face with the dew of the grass this morning. Me and the kids were out doing this morning. It keeps your complexion clear for the year and everything else. But there'll be a lot of sort of traditions associated. It's a fertility festival and a fire festival.
When you say fertility, do you mean like baby making?
Well, fertility is supposed to be the plants are all coming back.
All right, so it's nothing to do with humans.
Very much is into that as well. People who...
Well, let's work it out. What today's May. May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December, January. So if you're born in January...
Yes, absolutely. Right. But no, the fact of the matter is with the fertility aspect of things there, you would have the people who would wish to be fertile, I suppose, or whatever.
Yeah,
like, would make offerings to thorn trees.
Right, okay.
The sort of thing. Traditionally, you would have brought yellow flowers.
And this is part. These are part of the customs and traditions then?
Yeah, very much here, Scotland, the Isle of Man. Would have been a huge, and even like the balcony stone circle over in the foe would be named.
So
after
when you went out to wash your face in the dew this morning,
yes,
was it to maintain a tradition? Is it superstition, or is it just
pretty
much thing to do with the kids?
Well, pretty much, it's one of them things that's going to cost you nothing to basically carry it out. If you know what I mean, whether any benefit of that.
And is there a particular focus point in the world of plants associated then with the balcony?
Yes,
festivals.
Yes,
or
there would be the hawthorn is the main one. That's the main focus of the whole festival would be the hawthorn. People would have like a May tree they used to dance around and stuff like that, or even make offerings to the tree. So the hawthorn was, the festival always coincided with basically hawthorn coming into flower.
But calendars have moved around in time. Can we sort of track the impact of that?
Pretty much at the time there was Pope Gregory the 13th changed the calendar.
So it was the Gregories.
Exactly. He lost 12 days somewhere along the line. So traditionally about, Baltna would have been around the 13th of May, and actually in our climate that's when the hawthorns would have been. They rarely were flowered for the 1st of May,
and people would take the hawthorns and hang them in.
Yes, you hang them over the door. Very important not to bring hawthorn inside,
right?
Because hawthorn flowers is the same chemical as rotten flesh, and because of that it was associated with death. So bringing hawthorn into the house was to bring death into the house,
you know. And this does talk to our greater relationship we did have with sort of nature on the outside, and religion was tied into that as well. You know, the land, the earth, the trees, the sea, the waters, you know, were really integrated into people's lives and belief systems as well.
Pretty much, I'd say the beliefs are just trying to make sense of the world around them. Even the traditional, the way you made offerings of yellow flowers, like around here, is whenever the ones are in flower. So obviously yellow flowers are what was dominating the landscape at the time.
Right, so bedding plants, you can put them out now, but there's a bit of an asterisk, is there?
Yes, exactly. Aye, so I'd be quietly confident to put them out.
You're 90% sure, I say.
About 90%. Aye. But the only thing is, if you can leave it a couple of weeks...
The end of May and June, you're pretty much guaranteed to have good results, aren't you?
Yes, exactly.
You can be out there now trying to make the best of the good weather, but you should do so in the knowledge that they could fail. We don't know what's going to happen mid-May, as unlikely as it might seem.
Exactly. No, I would say if you leave it from mid-May on, you'd be grand. Sometimes if you sacrifice a week at the start... You can maybe make a month at the end.
Yeah, but sometimes, you know, growth is like a switch bean tripped, isn't it? And we have seen the conditions lately whereby, you know, grass growth is really booming at the moment. And I presume that relates to other plant life as well.
Absolutely, I know. Everything, in the last, the sort of, you had a bit of rain and then that, like, the last few days heat came along and you can visibly see the difference in the plants.
Yeah, it's almost like they were primed,
ready to go.
Fruit trees. There's always a lot of questions in relation to this. When's the right time? Now is a good time to plant a fruit tree.
Now is perfect time to plant a fruit tree. Generally, they're available. They're available in pots from garden centres. So if you plant a fruit tree in now, even soft fruit bushes like your black currants, gooseberries, you will get a harvest off them this season.
Wow.
It might be huge if you know what I mean, but you still will get something.
And when we talk about fruit trees, does that extend to your apple trees and stuff as well?
Yes.
Or are you talking more the likes of gooseberries? Do people still plant gooseberries?
Oh, yeah, it'd be very popular for
Love
jam and stuff like that.
Well, I just like eating them. They're hairy little buggers.
They're a bit bitter.
But is that not nice?
I like them. A wee bit sweeter now. Very much fruit trees that do well around here. You have apples, pears, plums, and cherries. All do very well. Mm-hmm. So you can plant any of them now at this time.
And if I want to go and get an apple tree from the likes of yourselves there, it's already matured to a certain level, has it? And it's ready to just be...
Generally, they're sold as about 5 years old. Right. So they will produce fruit in the first season.
Wow. Really? Okay. And how tall would a 5-year old apple tree be?
Most of them are grafted now to remain sort of in the region of sort of 5 to 6 feet. And that they'll max out at about 9 feet.
Okay. Very good. So that's very accessible. Okay. Strawberries, we mentioned as well. Strawberries feel a little bit exotic. You know, blackberries, gooseberries, they seem a bit, you know, okay. Strawberries, they seem, for me, I don't know why, they seem a bit more exotic.
Strawberries, great thing to grow with kids because actually you have visible results very
quickly.
And they're
tasty. And they're
tasty. And you have actually, if you're tight for space as well, you can actually grow them in a hanging basket. And they grow quite well because they're up out of the way of the slugs and stuff like that.
And they will continue to come back year after year, will they, if they're well maintained?
Generally, a strawberry plant, you'll get 2 to 3 years out of it. But very easy to propagate.
Yeah.
So whenever it's coming to the end of the season, you can actually take from your parent plant, you could take like maybe 20, 30 wee plants for next year's
Brilliant,
crop.
Okay.
So they're one of the easiest things to propagate.
Yep, there you go. We're going to get questions on roses as we always do. They remain popular, don't they? What's the maintenance or upkeep of them at the moment?
Upkeep of them, generally, if you haven't already done so, maybe give them a feed. You get granular feed for roses, for fertilising the roses. Would be important. You want a lot out of them for the year, so it's important to put a good bit of stuff out.
But you can plant them now as well.
You can plant them now as well, exactly. And just from now on, it's a wee bit cold yet, but from now on, green fly will become a problem. And the new shoots coming out are sort of softer and sweeter, so they're more susceptible to the green fly.
Yeah.
So just keep a wee eye to them.
To do what? To nip them in the bud?
Yeah, pretty much. Now, if you see the green fly emerging, like it's... If you spot it early, before it becomes a proper infestation, it can be easier dealt with.
Right, okay. Now, lawns again, what is the situ now in terms of cutting them? Because we've talked in the past about the risk of frost and cutting them down too low, but there's problems in dry weather too. I think a lot of our land, not all of it though, is, you know it's good drainage and not much lying water and stuff, so it can dry out really quite quickly.
They can, and a lot of lawns can go very hard quite quickly. So at time, if the weather continues... it obviously it's broken today, but if it continues to be very hot, maybe just be a wee bit more sparing with cutting the lawn.
Yeah.
Maybe lift it a wee bit higher just to not stress the grass too much.
Yeah, but you can understand you want the results, don't you?
Absolutely.
So you go
and funny, a lot of people actually enjoy the process of cutting the grass.
I don't know anyone that says I hate cutting the grass.
I'll probably
need more friends. We still have time to get questions in to Paul, by the way. We have a number in already. If you've got a question about anything, you know the story. There's no point me giving examples. Get them into us right now. When is the best time to feed a Portuguese laurel and what do you feed it with? So what is a Portuguese laurel?
Portuguese laurel sort of...
They've just spelled it a different way. Okay.
It's a slightly more refined version of the common laurel. Generous, nice plant. You have sort of reddish stems almost and sort of smaller leaves. But good enough hedge. Feed it now. basically it's just actively starting to grow. So that'll be a candidate for our friend the poultry manure.
Yeah.
So it would be.
Where do you get that? Sorry.
Any garden centre.
It comes in bags?
Buckets, generally. It comes in buckets because it stinks, basically. Yeah. So the buckets keep it sealed in better than the bags, if you know what I mean.
All right, okay. Yeah. Oh, so, but that, for me, smell means activity and
vitality in it.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Do you put straw with your strawberries? Apparently it stops them rotting. Is this true?
Yes, a lot of people do put straw under the strawberries where the fruit are going to emerge, if you know what I mean. It's a good idea because straw is quite rough. Slugs are less inclined to travel over it, so it keeps the slugs back. Right. And if the ground's damp, it actually does hold it up a wee bit more. To actually keeps them off the damp ground a wee bit more. So straw around them is a good idea, all right.
How can I make my grass greener?
Grass greener, generally fertilizer is the key, as much as anything else. Because you're cutting the grass a lot, you're taking a lot of energy out of it, basically. Mm. So if you want to, there are 1,000,001 different fertilizer options out there.
But I've seen in the past, grass cut, and it can look a little bit jaded, but it can bounce back itself as well.
Yes, generally it will bounce back within 3-4 days if it has been scalped, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Like, but no, generally it bounce back. But generally, if you get advice on it, even you get wee testing kits there, you can see what it's lacking. Mm. People are going away from, used to be just throw nitrogen at it, but people are becoming more sort of aware that they're cutting down the amount of nitrogen put into ground, because it's not always that's a problem, if you know what I mean.
Exactly, so
you can get wee kits to test what
you're
lacking.
Where do you get them?
Generally, most garden centres would have.
Right, okay, brilliant. So it will say you're, I don't know, what I don't even know.
It could be lacking lime, it could be lacking sulfur, something like that. You know, and you can actually apply then what it needs, if you know what I mean, rather than just throwing a general.
How do you know when garlic's ready for picking from pots?
Garlic in pots, generally the foliage on it, the foliage is almost like scallions of sorts. Whenever it's actually, you can sort of pick it and use it any time, but whenever the foliage starts to die back, it turns yellow, sort of starts going backwards, like a daffodil would it dies back, if you know what I mean.
Your garlic has got everything it's going to get from that
pretty
plant
much
then.
And then it's sort of the plant itself drying out a wee bit, so then it'll store.
Yeah,
you see people tie it up and all, so it'll store quite well at that point.
Right, okay.
But I wouldn't be overly concerned. If you want to just pick it and use it this week, you can just pick it at any stage.
Alright, great stuff. I had a man in doing work and he sprayed weed killer on my plants and trees. I have an Acer tree.
Acer, yeah.
It's not mature yet. What can I do to save it? That stuff carries in the wind. I've had a problem with this before, where someone was doing a bit of weed killing on the 30-year-old tarmac, and whatever way the wind was blowing, it carried it over onto the grass. So it is a real concern.
Yes, it can. The likes of an Acer tree, if the leaves were off it, it shouldn't actually be that affected, you would hope.
Is that because that's how it might absorb it?
That's exactly, because into the leaves. Mm. But if it's, it depends on what sort of weed killer they're using. If it's a systemic stuff.
Let us know. Listen, get back in touch, because that was a call that just came in.
Yeah.
Do you know what weed killer it was or what he was using it for?
Yes, because if it's systemic, it'll probably go into planting and probably not a lot you can do.
Right. And would that kill an Acer tree?
If enough got on it, theoretically. But if the leaves were off it, you might actually be safe.
But if they
enough.
Sprayed it around the base of it?
It shouldn't affect it that badly,
no. Because that might be the case. Yeah. All right, let us know more about that and we can give you a firmer prediction. Is it a good time to plant a hedge, a green beech, and does dead lawn grass help with fertility of them?
Green beech generally is a plant people have been familiar with. Generally is available more commonly in the bare root season, which goes from November to March. So you're a wee bit late this year. In terms of if you want to get them, that they usually are available in garden centres and pots, but it wouldn't be as common for it to be, and generally works out a bit more expensive. So if you're not in a panic, I would nearly wait again until the dormant season, which would be sort of from November on.
And what can we do with the cuttings from a lawn? Because people will have a pile, and actually it's quite, I put my hand into it once, roasting.
Yes.
Absolutely roasting and gluggy.
Yes.
You know, it kind of had sort of went into a brownie kind of a mess. I think I saw it steam. I can't remember why I put my hand
into
it. It's
quite common. You would see some steaming already.
There was a curiosity to it. Is that any useful function? It sounds to me like it could be very deading, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
I don't know.
A very limited amount of it that's going to sort of rot down in an acceptable time is grand, if you know what I mean. But to put that big like lump of slimy mush around it
does
wouldn't
start
be a good,
being really slimy, doesn't it?
Generally, like that, if you have a hedge that you cut regularly, it's a good idea to put in your, basically for a compost heap, you want sort of a certain amount of woody stuff, like even cardboard does the job, and a certain amount of that nitrogen-rich stuff, like the grass cuttings. So it's a matter of getting that balance right, so it doesn't go all sort of slimy. if you know what I mean. So if you're putting it around a hedge, I would use a wee bit maybe, but don't leave it in against the trunk of the plant. It can actually rot it a wee bit.
Yes, I can imagine, yeah. Because it is rotting itself, yes, that's what's happening. Exactly. This is the kind of question I might ask. Talking about feeding roses, if I do it now and it rains, does it wash all the goodness away or do I need to feed them again?
Yes, no, actually the rain washing the fertiliser in is actually beneficial.
Mm.
And so you want the actual benefit of the thing to get into the roots, if you know what I mean. So no, it washing down into the ground is actually what you want.
So it feeds from both what's exposed and what's underground.
Yes, generally probably 90% of the feed would go in through the roots.
There you go.
So no, it getting washed in is actually, obviously if it's torrential maybe you'd wonder about it getting washed away, but no, a nice wee bit of rain like we've had lately would be perfect.
Just to double check the daffodils, I cut off the dead flower blooms of daffodils and I leave the leaves to naturally die back. Is that the right thing to do?
Yes.
Because that's the food for next year.
Yes,
exactly. Hi Paul, I have a peach tree in my polytunnel which is growing big. Should it be moved outside at any stage?
No. Peach trees around here have to stay inside. We haven't climate.
So how do you limit its height then?
Limit its height. Obviously, it's a bit late now because the fruit should be set on it. Mm. Actually, a friend of mine sent me a message the last day showing the fruit tree, or the peach tree, and it's covered in peaches at the minute. So
I love peaches.
Another hard to beat, especially the homegrown ones there. But
you brought peaches up here before, didn't
you? Yes, we would have them down there.
Yeah, I know it sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but it was like a melt in your mouth peach.
You
literally need no teeth for it anyway. It was delicious.
I know, it's just much better than shop bought.
Mm.
But no, generally, the tree like that there, if it's getting too big for it, I would leave it this year, unless it's like pushing the cover, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But you can cut it back quite hard in the wintertime then, because it grows the fruit on.
Can you literally top it like?
Yeah, very much. Okay. And it produces fruit in this year's timber, if you know what I mean. So you'd actually be hard to cut it back quite hard, just as you get peaches next year.
Yeah, all right. I have a laurel hedge in for 3 years now. In the past 2 years, the leaves are yellow and are withering. What's the problem and what can I do? Is it lacking something like, say, for instance, chicken poo?
That's exactly what it's lacking. So it is. Laurel is a very hungry plant.
Yeah.
It likes a lot of nutrition. So it's important you'd be feeding it maybe twice a year with your poultry manure. And the fact of the matter is,
so if I have a bucket of this manure, right, and I've got a laurel hedge, am I like scooping it in and scattering it around sort of the trunk that's going into the ground?
Pretty much, just a wee bit out from the trunk, like, but just generally sort of spreading it along the hedge.
And that will naturally filter down.
Exactly. And it's if you're familiar with it, actually, whenever it comes to the buckets, it looks like cattle nut.
Yeah.
And basically spread on top of the ground.
Do they break down then with
once
moisture?
Once they get wet.
Wow, okay. Just,
and then the goodness travels down.
Brilliant, simple as that. So get a bucket of the chicken poo and that will do the trick. It's hungry.
Yes, it's hungry, exactly. Yeah. So if you wanted that nice lush green colour, feed it now and every 3 months, so that's May, June, July, August, about middle August.
Okay. Yeah. They also put a net over it and pebbles to keep weeds down. And the wondering, has that contributed to the lack of growth?
No, I wouldn't have thought so, to be honest.
Yeah. Okay. How long can you keep cherry blossom trees in pots? We haven't started building our forever home yet, but would like to get some trees now, if possible. So do they have them currently in pots, do you think? And they're wondering if you should go out and plant them on site, or I'm not...
Yes, I would be an advocate of waiting at that point. Generally, you can buy them in garden centres. You can buy them at various heights. So if you want a more mature tree, you can buy a more mature tree at the time. To be honest, I wouldn't be a fan of planting stuff in building sites. Like, it's quite a common thing you get asked. People want to plant the plants, so whenever they move into the house, the plants are established.
You just buy one that's a year older.
Exactly, because if you do it and, like, with the best intentions of the world, pipes have to go here and pipes have to go there, and they can end up getting dug up.
It's just a pain in the backside.
Pretty much. In terms of maintaining it in a pot, you can do, if you have a big enough pot, you could put it in for
But
three,
I love
four
what
years.
They're trying to do here. I can imagine, and I could be wrong, but they've got a really exciting process ahead of them, and they sort of want to start and putting their touch, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
Because it feels like sometimes, when's the builder going to land, or when's the subfloor going in, and you kind of want to see stuff being done, don't you?
Yes, you want to see the progress as it goes along.
Yeah, Japanese knotweed growing in the garden. How do I get rid of it? And I suppose how to responsibly to get rid of it as well,
that's
which is really critical.
Yes, so digging it out is not an option because you've got to move it anywhere. Like, even to move it, you can move it sort of within your own site, but you can't take it anywhere. And digging it out, you're not going to get it all anyway. So first thing is,
so it's weeds meander then, I take it. Sorry, it's weed. Did I say weeds? It's roots meander then.
Exactly.
All over the shop
today. And it can grow from 0.7 of a gram of a root that's left behind. So chances of you, though, Probably the first thing would be sort of seek professional help. There are plenty of companies out there.
Yeah, but that's programs expensive, and, though,
it can be expensive. It's, first of all, don't panic. It's not actually as scary as it's made out to be.
Yeah.
Like in the media, there's always just end of the world stuff, you know what I mean? But it's not. So it does respond quite well to weed killer.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is one of the cases where there is no real organic alternative.
Solution, you know have to go in there with the big stuff.
But basically, apply weed killer and you probably have to do that 3-4 times.
And is that killing it or containing it?
No, it'd be actually killing it because the systemic weed killers go into the plant and go down into the root and they will kill it off in that
sense. Yeah, so the chemical will reach all elements
exactly,
of it.
Exactly, yeah. So, but it's a case, because it's such a strong plant, you could be chatting maybe over the course of 2-3 years.
But it can be in quite a concentrated area. You know, people might not like to use chemicals, but the more I don't mean concentrated in terms of the water addition, but in terms of space, you know, where you're...
Yes, exactly. There are actually... Because it's a plant with a hollow stem, you want to be super sure that it doesn't get anything else, you can get guns or syringes on them that you actually inject.
I was thinking that while I was listening to you, I was thinking if you were getting a syringe in.
Yes, but that's a very, very labor intensive.
Okay. It's a tough one, but as you say, it's not necessarily the big bad wolf that some would make out. There was a point the conversation was about it literally taking houses down and stuff. It is dangerous, but I mean, at the end of the day, it can be dealt with. And there are companies out there. It depends on your resources. There are companies that out there that will come and do that. Presumably, they'd be licensed to remove it, would they?
No, removing it's a very dodgy, but would have to go to a special landfill site. And that generally,
I'm just wondering if you're paying someone. Maybe
generally they'd be treating it on site.
Okay, right.
Moving it's not a problem. It's a kind of a no-no.
Mossy lawn. I think people should be patient. Give the lawn plenty of light. Try and get rid of shadows and stuff.
Yeah.
And see how it goes.
Oh. Yes. Generally, it's part of that sort of what happens during the winter. Like if there are a pile of leaves lying on, someone like that there and with the actual, the moisture's being retained on it, even just cleaned up a few times over the winter helps to reduce it a bit. Otherwise, if you have a very mossy lawn, scarifier would be the main one. It'll pull out a lot of the moss. And then if you overseed it, you're removing the population of moss.
So when you're seeding, will the seed just take sitting on the surface? Is there anything, so say you distribute grass seed, is there anything you have to do after that?
Generally, no. If the weather's like today and sort of dull and that wouldn't be, if the weather was like a few days ago, it'd be a good idea to water it every so often.
Yeah.
Just keep the moisture.
But you don't have to rake over it or anything?
Generally, if you're overseeding a lawn that exists, I wouldn't bother, to be honest. And if you're using a machine like a scarifier, even raking the moss out of it, you're creating wee channels in the ground.
Yes, okay, so one action is having the reaction that benefits the next process. All right, brilliant stuff. Paul, thank you very much. Any questions we didn't get to today, we'll carry over. But as I say, it's a good time. If you're determined to go out and start doing your bedding now, you can, but be of the knowledge that there is certainly a potential risk.
Yes.
I would say that risk is zero. You are at 90%.
Oh, I was saying minimal.
Your view and mine is you're a professional and I'm an idiot. I would take your advice. All right, Paul, listen, thanks very much indeed. Paul McLaughlin, down at Ballagher Garden Centre. They're just down the road from us here. You can call in and ask any questions, bring photos. He might even go on bloody Google Maps. You never know. Paul's pretty dedicated to his craft. And also, of course, you know, there's loads of brilliant garden centres around our region as well. And they're all equally as friendly. And I've got great people like Paul working in them. Paul McLaughlin, thanks so very much indeed.
Thank you.
Now, 91% of people believe Irish society has failed to address child sexual abuse. Julie Brown is the Deputy CEO of One in Four and joins me now to talk about this a little further. Julie, thank you so much for your time.
Good morning, Greg, and good morning to your listeners.
So what view is that 91% expressing, I suppose, in more detailed terms, Julie?
Well, I suppose the key issue is that in the CSO figures of 2022, unfortunately, the rates of child abuse in our society have increased, and we now have 29% of people who have experienced sexual violence in childhood, and really alarmingly, that rises to 41% among the 18 to 24 age group. So part of my guess would be that they're looking at the statistics and thinking this is an issue that's getting worse. I mean, I think our key message today, though, and coming out of from the work that we have done, is that this is to get the message across. This is a preventable issue. that child sexual abuse is not inevitable. It's a preventative issue, and we're trying to encourage society as a whole to come together to tackle the issue. So my guess would be, and I think the positive thing from the Red Sea poll is that there is obviously a mandate among a representative sample of our society to do that.
And do you think those who are affected by this, and as you say, the numbers are really quite stark, feel that maybe society has moved on? They think, right, there's better safeguarding in the church, for an example. There's Garda vetting with people that work with children. You know, people know that this is unacceptable behaviour in the home. I'm not saying that that's all the case. I'm saying, do you think there is a concern that that's society's perception of it, that this isn't an issue any longer as such?
Well, I think, to be fair, all those things you mentioned, well, perhaps not the home, but the other things you mentioned around Garda vetting, the safeguarding in the church, those measures have been and are very effective. So what we found is that, you know, that when you dig down into where the risks for children or young people lie, they're no longer, like, if you look at the research, it will say for the older age group, the 55 plus, a higher percentage of people who abuse them were figures of authority. When you look at the younger age group, the 18 to 24 year olds, a lot of the abuse is happening in peer group.
So or online, I'd imagine, is it? As well?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And
online.
There's a crossover there. There's a crossover, obviously.
There's a huge crossover. So there's a kind of, I suppose, the toxic messaging young people are getting. I mean, I think it's probably fair to say the online environment in general is a callous one. And then when you add in kind of sexuality and pornography and sex into that, it amplifies that. And the objectification, the kind of the really, really toxic messaging. And then I think, you know, one of the things is we still find it very, very difficult. And it is difficult to speak about, I suppose, healthy boundaries, healthy sexual relationships. And I think without those kind of conversations and guidance to young people from across the board, unfortunately, pornography is filling that gap and children are being educated from really, really young ages 9, 10, 11, up, and getting really toxic messages from the online environment in general and pornography in particular.
And there just really isn't enough countermeasures. And strangely, when we do try and introduce them, there's resistance to them. I think sometimes maybe people bury their heads into sand as to what young people are being exposed to and the fact that we have to do something to try and counter that.
Yes, I think that there's two things. I think it can feel absolutely overwhelming, and therefore it's a bit like people naturally, when we're overwhelmed, we want to stand back from something. And I think our message is that, you know, it is possible. I mean, the things that you mentioned there around safeguarding in the church, we can see that those measures have worked. It is possible to come up with measures. And really what we're saying is it's a very complex issue, but what we would like is a whole society preventative. What we're calling for right now is kind of a society, a preventative approach. So what we don't want, we have enough insights and enough data now to understand where the risks lie. We don't want to always be looking back and thinking, kind of aghast, and thinking, this was terrible.
So enough now. What is 1 in 4 suggesting in terms of this preventative framework? I know it's up to legislators really to bring this, you know, through the process. But I mean, obviously, the likes of 1 in 4 have a huge insight into this. So when we're talking about preventative measures, what might that look like?
Okay, so we're looking at different levels within that. So I suppose the very bottom level is a whole of society where people are educated around the risks. And it's important. Obviously, there are kind of programs in schools to kind of teach children, and hopefully your kind of children are being supported to find a voice if something doesn't feel okay or safe. But it's broader than that. I mean, children can't protect themselves. It is, the responsibility is on adults and society. So there's that whole kind of whole of society approach. And then the next level up from that then is where people are at risk. So it's called secondary prevention. So if people, for example, are a more at-risk group, and that might be somebody who's having, for example, concerning thoughts about children, or finding themselves gone down a rabbit hole on the internet and doesn't know how to stop. So it's really important then that there is kind of, you know, prevention approaches available to those people. And so I suppose that's more targeting at-risk groups. And then there's, you know, as you go up, it's kind of a triangle, if you imagine, kind of with primary prevention at the bottom, right up to kind of what's called quaternary prevention at the top. You've got tertiary prevention, which is where the harm has already happened. And then you're trying to minimise harm, reduce risks of further harm. And then you've got, like, at the top, you have to always ensure that what you're doing is empirically guided, is being evaluated. So I suppose it's like, and that, because that's quite complex, it requires, you know, as you say, it requires politicians, it requires NGOs, it requires TUSLA, people, communities, the judiciary, lawyers, mm-hmm. everybody who touches on this issue to kind of work together in a kind of collaborative and evidence-based way to kind of action. So,
yeah, I was going to say, do we in the public have a role in relation to this? Because, you know, people will have delivered into their timelines on social media, you know, stings whereby someone may have been trying to meet a young person. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people will watch that and be aghast to it, quite rightly so. But that's maybe the one out of God knows how many that was caught by a group, for an example. Sometimes we're so worried and march and do whatever for what might happen. I do worry sometimes we take our eye off the ball of what actually is happening and not just what's fed to us. Do you know what? I just wish we could think a little bit more about saying, right, this is the state of play right now. What could we be doing as communities to better protect our children?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that example you gave of the kind of, I suppose, the vigilante type situation, I think part of the difficulty with that is it locates a problem in an individual. And if we can find this, I suppose, what's called a bad apple in the research, it's like, if you can find this person, the problem with that is it locates this very, very complicated and complex issue in one systemic issue, actually, in one individual. And it gives a kind of a false sense of, you know, throw them out and that will solve the problem.
Yeah.
Really, really what we need, I mean, I think what's quite sad is that the vast majority, you know, when we say disclose, what we mean by that is that an individual who's been abused or harmed in childhood has told just one individual, one other person. It doesn't mean that they've told the police or authorities, just told one person that this has happened. And 45% of women have told somebody, and only 22% of men have told somebody. So that makes the issue invisible. And what we know from the work we do, both with survivors and with people who've perpetrated, is that it does not stop until there's we need the disclosure. So as a society, I think it is about informing ourselves, having kind of compassionate conversations, making it safe. There's still a huge stigma associated with, you know, people are afraid to disclose. Sometimes children are afraid to disclose in that internet discourse that you mentioned. Sometimes they think it's not bad enough.
Yeah, but our role, is to create a framework in our own homes that allows that information to be shared without the child thinking they're going to get into trouble, for an example, or they're going to be blamed, or they're going to be, you know, why would you send that picture to, you know what I mean? You need to sort of, don't you, create your own little personal framework.
Yes, children are navigating a space that they can't possibly understand, that adults find it difficult to navigate. So I think that's one aspect, you're quite right, in terms of not getting into trouble, there not being a shaming element. And the other important thing, because this has come out of research, we were very lucky, Karen Hand, who did the research, was able to interview young people who'd experienced abuse as part in Children's Health Ireland. And one of the barriers for them, they said, was they knew their parents would be so upset. They knew their parents would be heartbroken. So they found it easier to speak to sort of a professional, because they knew professionals were kind of accustomed to hearing. So I think it's for parents to be able to kind of convey that message, whatever has happened, it'll be okay. We can work through this. We'll get help.
Because invariably you will. It's how you react in the first instance, isn't it? And also, notwithstanding what the state needs to do and the calls that you've made as well, but if we also have to consider young people are experiencing that level of abuse by peers, well, those peers potentially are also in our homes as well. So how do we counteract those online narratives? How do we educate them? Does it mean having that awkward conversation about sex and the parameters of that and what consent is and what is and isn't correct? I saw a conversation, a debate going on online where there were fully grown men on the X platform, well, I don't even know what I should say. Well, I will say it, that we're saying that it's okay to restrict someone's breathing during intimate experience.
Yeah.
Remarkable that these adults have been completely and utterly educated by pornography and would make that argument. Those are fully grown adults. So what are our young men being exposed to in this space as well? And what do they believe is right or wrong? And unless we talk to them, how can we counteract what they're being told?
Exactly, and that's really, really vital, and not just around, you know, absolutely vital to have a conversation around consent. And parents may not feel equipped to have these conversations, but there are lots of resources. Also, I think a lot of parents, including myself, are not tech savvy enough. You know, we have the protections on the phones, whatever. You know, my teenage children are much more tech savvy than me and are keep managing to get around them. And it's, you know, you're back to the drawing board and how do you get the apps back on? But it is about the really, really toxic discourse around women and young girls that's in pornography and address it. You know, I mean, pornography, I wonder if, you know, because you're quite right, sometimes there's a sort of a kickback. And I think it's not about people not being repressed or not having healthy kind of sexual experiences. But the vast majority of the content of pornography is actually violence.
Yep.
Like, you know, marked violence.
Yeah. And the truth is
male to female directed.
Yeah, for sure. And the truth is, if there wasn't such a resistance from fully grown adults, we would already have a system whereby you would have to have ID to access that pornography. But it's actually the resistance is coming from adults who are afraid, firstly, of being identified themselves accessing this stuff or not wanting to share that information. Sadly, I'm sorry, I'm going off on a tangent here, Julie, but I think it is all part of the one thing here, and especially when young people are victims.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. 1 in 4 is there to support people as well, of course, Julie, as well as advocating and campaigning, which has sort of been what we've been talking about so far. But you talked about the importance of telling another person or sharing or seeking help, and 1 in 4 has that role too, of course.
Absolutely. If you're, you know, a survivor, please, you know, lift the phone. We recognise it's a very difficult call to make. You'll be met with warns. People will go at your pace. You know, it's, as I said, that sometimes the hardest thing is kind of lifting the phone, and you will get a warm response. And if you've been upset by any of this conversation, please, if you're one of the almost 80% of men or 55% of women who haven't been able to make that call yet, help is available.
Do it today. Do it today. Okay. All right. Thank you very much indeed. Julie Brown, Deputy CEO of 1 in 4. In the last 18 minutes of the 9 till noon show. Really appreciate all your calls and comments coming in so far. Lots of them positive, of course, some raising issues. A caller says, I was in Downing's yesterday. I had to use the public toilets. They were absolutely disgusting. There were thick cobwebs. The paint was flaking. There was excrement smeared all over the toilets. Ooh, you'd be better off not washing your hands. The sinks were so dirty. How can a busy village be like this? Is there no money to pay to clean these toilets? Dunfanaghy public toilets and Rathmullen are well kept. Both are also busy seaside villages. Now, I've had occasion to use those toilets in Downing's. Generally okay. Public toilets in and of themselves wouldn't be my favourite places. But anyway, listen, maybe someone will have a look at that and see what can be done. Now, you will have contacted us in the past about the quality of school meals. And the one thing I've learned is that it's very hit and miss. You'll have one school, the parents are absolutely delighted and they think the food is brilliant and nutritious. And then you get another school not far away and the experience is completely different. So I respect that it's hit and miss dependent on which school you have and I suppose which company got the contract. Janine Kennedy has been working on a similar story nationwide. She's food journalist with the Farmers Journal. We're talking about a nutritional review for the school meals scheme and what to expect from that. Good morning, Janine. How are you?
Hi, Greg. I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Right, so thousands of younger people are eligible for these school meals. So what have you been looking at and what have been your findings or where are we going with this?
Well, there's not a whole lot to report on new or recently in terms of the school lunch program. It's kind of time for review, I suppose. It's after kind of the first year of it being in place for a lot of the schools. Now there are over 500,000 students who are able to get this lunch. And I think it's to, like you said, mixed reviews from parents and from principals alike, and especially in rural areas, which is where we would largely focus on in Irish Country Living. So there aren't that many things to report on just yet. But as you said, there is a nutritional review going on with the government. That's going to be by the end of 2025 that they're expecting a report to Minister Cleary. And hopefully it's going to solve a few of the issues, though we're not quite sure that a nutritional review will solve you know, the main issues, I suppose, associated with
your viewing of this as well has found mixed reviews, the exact same as the sort of feedback we get from listeners. That some believe it a complete waste of money. The lunchbox come back, nothing's been touched. The food, you wouldn't feed it to a cat. And others think it's the best thing since, dare I say, sliced bread.
Look, Greg, it's the same in my own household. I have three kids. They were in a DESH-designated school, so they've been getting lunches for a bit longer than a lot of the other schools who are not DESH-designated. Originally, it was a DESH program. They send you home the food that the kids don't eat. And frankly, my children come home with uneaten chicken goujons every day. It's not even, you know, it's not even a choice anymore in terms of the menu. And like so many rural schools, mine didn't really have many options when it came to choosing their caterer. The law is that it's down to the school to choose the catering company who can provide the lunches for the school. And depending on the school itself, I mean, a lot of smaller rural schools do not have the kitchen facilities to be reheating things. So they need to find a larger catering company who can supply the ovens to reheat the lunches to the appropriate temperature, as well as be able to provide these lunches to the kids. So that was the case in our own school.
Or even find someone who's willing to provide catering, because, you know, some schools in your report have found that you know, they can't find a caterer.
And usually the only school that can, or the only catering company that can supply to these smaller schools are really, really large ones who are really mass producing meals. And I'm not calling anybody out. Nobody is going to begrudge a child a hot meal during school, especially if that child, if it's the only hot meal they might be getting that day. That's so important. But I think that there are a lot of people in the food area in Ireland who are food professionals like myself, you know, food journalist, but I'm also a chef. I think that there's a wealth of information and expertise in this country that can really help transform this program into something that will teach kids holistically about food and where their food's coming from, as well as providing the nutrition that they need. And I suppose the fun, making it a fun experience for them.
Sorry, I just found myself as when you mentioned you're a chef, I would love to be in your house when you open up the uneaten food and it's a couple of chicken nuggets sitting at the bottom.
It just makes you want to cry. It makes you actually.
Because the resources are going.
I quit my job as a journalist and just start doing the catering for my own school.
Because the resources are there, aren't they, Janine? You know, there is funding there, and there doesn't seem to be a standard, and I presume, you know, that there'll need to be a basic nutritional standard. Because as I say, so many companies are knocking it out of the park. So we need to find out who's doing it well, how they're doing it well, so that every child has the same experience.
And now the government has said that coming into September of this year, there's going to be rules around highly processed foods and around saturated fat, sugar levels and fat levels and salt levels. And so that's definitely coming in for September. And up until now, it was kind of once a week and up to parents to decide whether or not they allow their children to have these kinds of foods. But like I said, in our case, that seems to have gone out the window completely. There used to be a choice, and now the kids are just really getting mini pizzas and potato cubes or chicken goujons and potato cubes every day. So
I mean, it's something, but that we could be doing something else. And it's actually a great space, I think, to help educate fussy eaters, because they see their peers at it, right? Rather than sort of going to the path of least resistance and mini pizzas and chicken
Greg.
Nuggets.
And I think it's great that they're putting it under nutritional review, but I think it's also kind of missing the point a little bit. I think if you get kids thinking about food a little bit more holistically, and if you make it fun for them, and I think, again, there should be other people in the consultation process as opposed to just nutritionists who might not even have children. Or, and
I know exactly, because there's lived experience as well as sort of learned experience. Get where you're coming from. I don't think that's in any way offensive at all. Listen, thank you so much, Janine. That article's in today's Irish Farmers Journal in the Country Living section, I believe. Thank you so much for that. Take care.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You very much.
So I said 3,200 in primary students. It's primary schools, obviously. It's a massive, massive thing. But as I say, you know, we will get various views on that. Some will say, it's fantastic. Our kids are happy. We're delighted with it. And others would say, it's thrown in the bin. It's inedible. All right. So I think, is it Commons we'll finish up with, shall we, Caroline? We'll take a break, come back with the weather, and then we'll catch up on some of the messages that have been coming in from you throughout the course of this wonderful Thursday morning. Fresh food every day, fried food no more than once a week, and the processed food no more than once a month. Is that what you think should happen, or is that what does happen? Spain has introduced new regulations to improve the health of school meals. Our government needs to take action on this. Yeah, fingers crossed, because there is a review coming up. Hi there. Are many disability toilets that you can't get into without a wheelchair and the door may open in? Thank you. Okay, there are many disability toilets that you can't get into. Yes, indeed. And I've noticed this in premises more so, whereby, you know, and I kind of naively, and I think I referenced this on the show before, that you know, there's three doors. There's a men's, a women's, and then there's a door for wheelchair users. And you don't go in. I haven't gone in. But I did happen to be out with someone in a wheelchair, and the toilet had the sign on the outside of the door, but it was in no way wheelchair accessible. In fact, actually, for someone in a wheelchair trying to use it, it would have been humiliating, I would argue. Interesting that our prisoners are already full. Our prisons are already full and crime is increasing. Where are the new offenders going to go? Well, they'll find way. They'll release that. Well, what generally happens, or what's happened in Britain, is they release people early to make the space, don't they? I qualified as a healthcare assistant recently. The going rate for the job is €13.50. Down the country, it is €17 or €18, and for the HSE, the pay for healthcare assistants is absolutely scandalous. And that was part of the ESRI's findings, that, you know, fully qualified people are on the minimum or not far above the minimum wage. A caller says Downing's is lucky to have toilets in Chrysler. We have to find a pub or a shop. Yeah, indeed. Biddy O'Barnes, it's a wonderful spot, isn't it? And it's always so busy. We've pulled in a couple of times, and it's always, I suppose, at peak time Sunday afternoon, and we've been driving, and we says, right, we'll see what the crack is in Biddy's, and it's always so blooming busy, it's so successful. Somebody's decided to borrow their beloved Guinness toucan, usually found in the shed at Biddy's. The toucan's been part of the pub for many years, and they'd really love to see him back where he belongs. They've got cameras, but they'd much rather he was just returned, and there'll be no questions asked. He was happy here, minding his own business, and let's get him home. Right, so maybe someone was play-acting here and took it with them, and it could be on the back of a bus or something. If you know where the toucan is, they want it back, and they have video evidence, but they prefer just to sort it out. It's not gone home. It's knocking about the place. So do you know where Biddy's toucan is? You can let us know. We'll let them know. Or in fact, we can be an intermediary, drop it out here, and we'll drop it down to them, something along those lines. There are only 13 waiting in the ED today. This is because the health minister is here for a visit. This is not the norm. Staff are always under pressure and run off their feet. How can it be empty today? Well, I double-check this because I do like to do my research. And there was a similar number in the ED last Thursday. Now, I didn't compare consecutive Thursdays. Now, these are early morning figures. It'll be very interesting to see what it's like at midday. The minister's down there now to see what the crack is. Hi, Greg. A big frustration for people is that these IPASS centres are exempt from planning, so local residents have no voice in relation to the impact these developments will have on the local area. They are and they aren't at times. The majority of the 15 or 16... applications for IPASS centres across the county, including Remelton, by the way. I couldn't find out what the situation was with Remelton, but there was an application, a Section 5 exemption sought for a location in Remelton. There is no IPASS centre planned for Remelton, just to clarify that. I just couldn't get clarification on that. But the council has rejected the majority of these Section 5 exemption applications. So to say they're exempt from planning, in the majority of cases, they are not exempt from planning. I think there was one in Letterkenny and one elsewhere that was deemed to be exempt. Hi, Greg. Ordinary people are realising that enforced change without consent is being forced upon them, that our councillors are complicit in it and supportive of unlimited mass immigration. Okay. Greg, in relation to electricity, my electricity renewal is up, so I shopped around. All variable rates are more or less the same. Only one is giving a fixed rate for a year at 28 cents. The variable rate is 25 cents, so there is no real difference. Plus, has anyone looked at the cost of shopping lately? Every week it's increasing. Yep, there's a problem in shopping around when there's no competition in the market. That is the case. So anyone got any electric companies they're offering better than 25 cents? At this point, I wouldn't be locking myself into a fixed rate because things look like they're going to calm down. It might take a while, but things look like globally they're going to calm down. And you have lots of gas and oil being produced or expected to be produced. So I would be edging my bets and sticking with the variable if it were I. I had an interesting conversation with a contractor yesterday who told me last week for the first time in years he was undercut for a job. Are we facing into the beginning of the end of cost inflation? Oh, I don't know. I would know of people that have got prices, and I'm not sure if there is. I think sometimes people price them out of stuff. So I said that, didn't I? Recost, Greg. Has anyone had their car insurance renewal lately? Mine came in yesterday. Last year, $545, fully comprehensive. This year, $790. What happened to the cost of insurance coming down? Well, listen, I say this time and time again, and then the next day or the day after, I get texts from people. Shop around, go to Chill, go to Quote Devil, go to your broker, whatever it might be. I guarantee you will either get $545 or less. Do not be loyal to someone who's trying to shaft you and get your insurance with them again. Please shop around. Let us know if you make any savings. Okie dokie. That's where we have to leave it on the show today. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9, and it's Friday again already, so we'll have the usual fun and conversation, serious and otherwise. So please come back, stay tuned for that. Hopefully by that point we'll have an interview with the Minister for Health. We're going to go down and see how we get on. But that's it for us for now.